Does drinking coffee help prevent dementia? Can diet soda give you cancer? If you find yourself confused when it comes to health and science reporting, you're not alone. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, Julie Ansager and Lori Walrath of the University of Iowa and Sarah Francis of ISU Extension will give us some advice on how to tell fact from fiction when we hear about new scientific studies and health tips. Then we talk about the state of science education in Iowa with Jeffrey Weld of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council and Gina Schademan, director of the festival series I Explore STEM. First, we get this update on the hour's news. Does drinking coffee help prevent dementia? Can diet soda give you cancer? Do angry-faced Legos harm our children? Is there a blood test for suicide? Does Facebook make you sadder? Well, these are some recent examples of science in the news you may have heard about, and if you find yourself confused when it comes to health and science reporting, you're not alone. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, all about our understanding of science. Later in the hour, I want to talk about the state of science education in Iowa with Jeffrey Weld of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council, how well things are going in school as far as science education. Also, Gina Schademan will be with us of a festival series called I Explore STEM. But first, how well does the media cover health and science issues? And when does junk science sneak through? How do you identify it? Simply put, how do we tell fact from fiction when we hear about new scientific studies, when we hear about those health tips? We'd like you to join our conversation this half hour. What science or health reporting have you heard recently that confused you or made you wonder how you should interpret the study, the finding, the health tip? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, or email, tweet us at IPR Talk, or find us on Facebook and post something there for us. Joining me, first of all, Julie Ansager is with us, professor and Moeller Research Scholar at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Julie Ansager, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, you study the framing of health information, message processing. You also conduct research on audience interpretation of health-related messages. I listed a few off there, but when we come across an article that cites an experiment, some kind of scientific information, something new in the news having to do with science, what questions should we be asking ourselves?
Well, the fact that you mentioned experiment as just a general term for science is one issue that we need to look at, because not all methods are the same. So, for example, in the Facebook study you talked about, that study was conducted by asking students, you know, how sad are you and how many hours do you spend on Facebook per day, for example. And that does not show us cause and effect. That's just the student's or the subject's perception of what they're feeling and what they're doing. We don't know if they were sad and that led them to Facebook, or they looked at Facebook and became sadder. Mm-hmm. An experiment, or in medical and science terms, what they refer to as randomized controlled trials, that's the gold standard, because that allows us to determine much better a cause and effect relationship. So the research method is something you want to pay attention to. And secondly, you want to pay attention very closely to who or what was being studied. You know, there's sometimes we'll see studies that talk about humans and the effects in humans when actually the study was tested in mice. And what happens in mice is not necessarily going to be what happens in humans, men and women, vice versa.
That would be the case with artificial sweeteners in diet soda, for example, wouldn't it?
Exactly. There was a study, a news story a few years ago about a compound in red wine that would help us live longer. But it was, if you read along, it was tested in mice. And in order to get the same effect, humans would have to drink 750 bottles of red wine per day. Problem there.
Right.
You also have to think about how many people or mice even were being studied and who sponsored the study. I would be leery of fully believing and fully trusting reports on an antidepressant's success that was sponsored by a pharmaceutical company, for instance.
Mm-hmm. But yet when we have the Facebook study that you mentioned, you brought out the obvious thing that we want to think about here, the cause and effect. But because of that news report, there are I would say, you know, the large majority of people who took in that report went around to office colleagues, maybe to family, maybe to friends, and said, oh, did you know Facebook can make you sadder? When that's not at all what was in there, right?
No, but the language that's used in trying to make a nice headline or a catchy lead, the first part of the story, is often not really representative of the rest of the story. So, for example, a headline that says that drinking coffee is linked to reduced suicides, you know, linked to makes it seem like we just kind of gloss over that, right? But linked to does not mean cause and effect. It just means there's some sort of relationship.
Lori Walrath is also with us in the Iowa City studio, professor and vice chair of the Department of Biochemistry at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Welcome to our program, Lori.
Thank you, Ben.
And I understand you train researchers and scientists to be better communicators to lay audiences and lay scientists. Historically, we have journalists informing the general public about scientific issues. These are non-scientists generally. What sorts of problems does this cause?
Yeah, so you're exactly correct. I train undergraduates, graduates, and medical students on how to better communicate their science, both to their broad scientific audiences as well as peer audiences. And I think the problem arises because scientists traditionally are not trained to communicate to a wide variety of audiences. And so they have challenges to distill their scientific information into information that can be easily digested by the general public.
Mm-hmm. So when you educate your researchers and scientists, what are the typical problems they have that they need to improve upon?
Well, the format for presenting scientific information to a scientific audience is entirely different from the format in which you would use to present the information to a lay audience. And I'm drawing mostly from some instruction that I was given through the National Science Foundation, taking a course up in Ames, Iowa, called Science Becoming a Messenger. And what it really enforced was the notion of a message triangle in which you identify a problem, then present the reason for the problem and a solution. And that's a very different format that would be used for scientists to give their typical scientific presentations to a science audience.
Mm-hmm. So you're teaching these scientists to stay within that triangle?
Yes, stay within that triangle, and most importantly, keep the triangle focused on one topic and also to frame the arguments that you're making. You can't mix a political frame with a financial frame, for example. You have to keep it focused. And I think that's in some ways very challenging for scientists to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you do introduce that to a scientist and the person is coming across this, they will have to contact the media, be a resource for the media. What is typically a reaction? Are they perhaps saying
they feel out of their element when they first learn the system, completely out of their mind? Professors who have also been taught this triangle and taught to use it effectively to communicate in interviews, phone interviews, on camera interviews, they feel very out of their element. It's a foreign format. And the problem that academic institutions face right now is that there's tracks to train the journalists and there's tracks to train the scientists, but rarely do the two ever meet.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever run into scientists, researchers who object to doing it that way, feeling maybe it's, I don't know, dumbed down in some way?
I don't know they object to it. I think there's a certain subset of scientists that feel that there isn't really a barrier in communicating to the lay audience. It's difficult for them to perceive that their message isn't getting across.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Francis is also with us in this first half hour, State Nutrition Extension and Outreach Specialist at Iowa State University. Good afternoon to you, Sarah.
Hi, Ben.
And you are trained in nutrition, but an emphasis on nutrition education. And so much of the reports that we have here have to do with nutrition, the caffeine and dementia, the soda causing cancer, diet soda, and so forth. When you read a news article, you watch the TV or listen to the radio, what are some red flags that you see, things happening that raise a red flag in your head?
Oh, there's several things. Anything that promises a quick fix raises a red flag in my mind. It suggests, are they just trying to sell a product to an uneducated consumer? Because most Americans have a below basic health literacy level, which impacts their ability to really discern what's being presented to them during the media. Anything that sounds too good to be true raises a red flag.
Do you have any examples out of the field of health that you point to?
For the too good to be true, there's so many weight loss programs. I'm on Facebook, and I am a happy person. But on Facebook, you always see, I see friends of mine post that, you know, they've just lost 6 pounds in a week following this one program. And that raises a red flag about what are they doing. I've noticed a lot of people doing cleanses on, you know, commenting on those. So that's an example of what I would see as something that's clean, is too good to be true. You may lose the weight, but you're not going to maintain that weight loss in any measure.
So Sarah, how do you follow up if you see a claim made in a media report about a health tip and they're all around us and it interests you? You may have a weight problem. What is the correct way to follow up and see whether there may be something in there, a lifestyle change in there for you that you can gain from?
I think in regards to nutrition, the best resource would be contacting a local registered dietitian. And Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, we have several nutrition program specialists around the state that can answer their questions. You need to find someone who has an ethical base to not just sell a product, but to provide you with accurate science-based, evidence-based research. Evidence-based means that we looked at the body of evidence. We're not basing it on just one study. We're looking at what have multiple studies found. The first speaker mentioned a randomized controlled trial. That is the gold standard, but there's many other valuable forms of research. So we look at the collective body of evidence and see what the recommendations are. And that's what a registered dietitian would provide you in terms of nutrition information. Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, we provide research-based, evidence-based research information. And healthcare providers also know how to wade through that information to help you make informed decisions. So my advice would be seek a professional within the field of the
My guess, Sarah, is that a small minority of us do that. Most of us look at it, read through the article on whatever Fox News or Huffington Post, and we say, "Oh, I'm going to do that. I'm going to eat more broccoli, or I'm going to do this or that." Is that your guess too?
Oh, absolutely. The questions that our answer line, which is a toll-free number people call, indicate that that's what consumers are doing. The questions that we field at the county level indicate that. If you just look at the internet with the dialogue, a lot of people are just, they pick and choose what they want to follow, which is, you know, part of being human and being an independent person. Mm-hmm. And it's just an extension. We're just really trying to make sure that we're steering them towards the information that is most credible.
Julie Ansager of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication, with the internet mentioned there, of course, that's been part of our media landscape for many years. But the sites like Google News, other aggregators, how have they affected the quality of health and science journalism, do you think?
Well, I think that they've certainly not helped it, because in order to get prominence on Google News, Google sites, for example, you have to have more hits. That's part of the algorithm. And so the more sensational the headline, the more interesting the lead, the more likely people are to click on it, and that's going to raise its prominence on Google. And that does not help improve the quality of news coverage. But secondly, I think one thing I do when I'm looking at news on Google, and particularly related to health, is just read the first couple of sentences or the first sentence that's there. And, you know, if it's not something that I feel particularly interested in, I'll just move on. And so we're not as likely, I think, to read the whole story. And reading the entire story is really important to understand the credibility of the story, the study, and what it means to you. Does it even apply to you?
Mm-hmm. So how does that translate into educating young journalists at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication, for instance, at the University of Iowa? How do you teach this? I mean, the market is demanding one thing. Can you teach your students something else and say, well, to heck with what your employer may say in the future?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to understand that there's two really distinct cultures when it comes to science and medical research and journalism. They have different goals. That is, scientists and medical researchers they know that one study is not conclusive, and they know that they have to replicate and repeat and try to generalize. Journalists, on the other hand, have the goal of getting a story, making it interesting, and getting it out within a certain deadline. So within the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Iowa, what we're trying to do is teach our students the methods, the importance of understanding the methods, the numeracy about how to calculate odds ratios, things like that, so that they can better convey that and better explain that to their audiences. Because if they don't understand a method, or they don't understand the what the statistics mean, they're not going to be able to explain it. And so we have courses in risk communication, health and medical communication, and we have social media and strategic communication courses that are relevant to health. And so I think education across the country is getting better. And so hopefully the medical and scientific reporting will continue to improve.
Lori Walrath, when you help train researchers and scientists to be better communicators to lay audiences at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa, do you also teach them about the journalist's perspective, what Julie was just talking about, so that they know who they're talking to and the frame, the glasses through which a journalist may see a researcher coming into this studio, for instance?
Yes. I mean, Julie phrased it exactly appropriately, as they have a particular mission, and the scientists really need to understand that mission before they perform the interview, and to know exactly what the journalist wants to get out of that interview. And with regard to new media, I think that scientists have been a bit resistant to embracing new media, but I think as they become more and more on board with the use of new media, we can begin to get some real science into the mix. And also those scientists that know what's not right and what's right can chime into the conversations that are online.
Mm-hmm. And Lori and others, you've certainly seen in our new media age, this is no longer the media age of three network television channels and PBS and printed newspapers on our doorstep every day. This is a 24/7 news media landscape, and with social media, so we have information that can spread like lightning, Lori, out there. And it doesn't mean it's true, right?
Right, and that's where we need scientists that have the knowledge in the background and the understanding of appropriate methodologies and the ability to critically critique scientific investigation, to chime in on those news media outlets with some authority and their degrees and their experience behind them.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Francis, I'm not sure how long you've been working at Extension there, but have you noticed in the years that you've been at work there that our social media, the growth of social media, the speed of the internet has increased the spreading of rumors that mean, you know, information about health that may not be true?
Absolutely, and we're trying to delve into it, reaching our public where they're at. So for the Nutrition and Health Extension team, you know, trying to get that information on our Facebook page, Pinterest. We are dabbling in Twitter. I wouldn't say that a lot of our energy is going on that, but also providing a lot of online programming and information on the website, because it's become that's where people want their information.
So you're like a rapid response team. You sort of forced into that, aren't you?
Yes. and that it's extremely challenging because, you know, we have what we consider core programming, looking at what are the health issues within the state of Iowa. But then we are also having to respond to the media responses. Just recently, an email came across claiming that carrots that turned white were soaked in bleach and the bleach was leaching out, and that you can't eat carrots that are white. And really, in fact, it's just the carrots are getting dehydrated and you just need to rehydrate them. And so we had to take time to respond to that. We respond through our statewide nutrition newsletter, Words on Wellness. We try to respond through that because we can reach about 45,000 people statewide with that. We respond through press releases and, as I mentioned, Facebook and those online resources.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask Julie about this too, but you first, Sarah, do you find that there are sources where people should have should be suspect, should put up their antenna more than others? What sorts of media organizations do a better job reporting health and science news?
I don't know about the media resources. I would leave that to Julie or Lori. But as far as health information, looking at the USDA, looking at eatright.org, which is the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, those national websites would be the best sources for health information from our perspective at Iowa State University. Since we are a land-grant university, we typically recommend the federal and professional or websites for those for that information.
Julie Ansager, what about the media organizations? Are there some that do a better job of reporting health and science news than others?
Oh, certainly. The number of newspapers and television networks and national magazines that have dedicated health reporters, particularly those with advanced degrees in science or MDs, tend to do the best jobs. That's the things like the New York Times, CNN until recently, Newsweek, and those kinds of entities. However, based on Twitter, I would also say that the Centers for Disease Control, which is CDC, at CDC, and the National Institutes of Health do a fabulous job in spreading information via Twitter. CDC had a really successful campaign in educating people a few years ago when they climbed onto that zombie craze and asked if you were prepared for the zombie attack, which is really about getting people ready for emergency preparedness. So I think just, you know, be really cognizant of who your source is and who's commenting in a story.
Mm-hmm. Lori Walrath, do you have anything to say about the sources you trust?
As Julie mentioned, I think that the best sources come from collaborations between journalism individuals and scientists. When they come together to write a book, to write an article, that seems to result in the best product.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a quick call if we can before we have to go. Bill in Sac City. Hi, Bill. Please make it quick.
Okay, good. Well, thank you for taking my call. And one of the underlying problems I see in this country is the fact that we have very, very few scientists in politics, and our politicians have very little understanding of science, and yet are making many decisions that are related to science. And an example of that would be like Mitt Romney's, in his GOP presidential candidate acceptance speech, ridiculed Barack Obama for his acceptance and belief in global warming. And I'm not picking on any particular side because, both sides of the aisle would fit into this. But I would just appreciate your comments as to the political atmosphere and the atmosphere that's created in this country that really doesn't respect and really value science. Mm. I'd appreciate your comments. Thank
you. Thank you, Bill, for making that point. I don't know if we have anybody on hand right now. Lori Walrath, would you like to tackle that?
Yes, I think you bring up a really good and very important gap in where there's a lack of cross-communication. And I think we need more educational programming of scientists to move into the political arena. Right now, the projections say that PhD-trained scientists, only 14% of those will be able to be placed in traditional academic job environments. And we really need cross-training for them to move into the political arena and begin to better inform the politicians on scientific issues.
Thank you for joining us this half hour. Lori Walrath is a professor and vice chair in the Department of Biochemistry at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Sarah Francis, State Nutrition Extension and Outreach Specialist at Iowa State University. Julie Ansager, Professor and Moeller Research Scholar at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Ladies, thank you very much for an insightful conversation. And we will beware the next time we read the next study or survey in our reports. Coming up in just a moment, we want to talk about the state of science education in our state with Jeffrey Weld of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council and Gina Schademann, director of the festival series called I Explore STEM. We'll find out all about that when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about our understanding of science this hour. Hope you were there for our first half hour. That was interesting. How we navigate news of new studies, surveys, health tips, you know. Maybe you heard the one about angry-faced Legos harming our children or Facebook users being made sadder. Well, we can all look at those with increased skepticism as we hear about new studies, new science surveys, and so forth. Well, this half hour, though, we want to talk about science education in Iowa, which for most of us doesn't set off any alarm bells, but listen to this. Troubling statistics continue to pile on, reminding us that the status quo in STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, education here in Iowa and across America cannot be defended. STEM fluency is no longer just a worthy initiative. It is an imperative to stave off the risk of becoming an irrelevant state of a slipping nation. Now, that strong call to action sprang from a recent study from 2011. It was found in the Iowa STEM Education Roadmap, a strategic plan for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education. Joining us now to talk about science education in Iowa and STEM, Jeffrey Weld, Executive Director of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council and Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Jeffrey Weld, welcome to our program.
Delighted to be here.
And we want to mention that prior to entering academia, you taught some high school, some science in high school for about 11 years, right?
11 years and thousands of students worth, right?
Okay. So, as I mentioned, science education in Iowa, that doesn't set off alarm bells for most of us, but do set off some alarm bells. What do we have to be concerned about when we look at recent years and the education in science our kids are getting?
Well, Ben, we've got something of a train wreck that we're trying to avert. Obviously, the economy of our state is heavily reliant on a STEM fluent or STEM literate population. Youth interest in the STEM fields powers a talent pipeline into the IT industry and advanced manufacturing and the biosciences. And so we've got that imperative to assure our industries that we've got a steady pipeline of talent to fill their employment needs. By many indications, we're not inspiring kids at the rate that we need to fulfill those opportunities. We're below the national average with regard to post-secondary STEM majors being chosen by our youth. We're below the national average when it comes to advanced coursework at the K-12 level among our kids. So we've got some work to do. We're not drawing kids of ethnic and racial minorities into the STEM pipeline as vigorously as we need to, given the demographics of our state. So, it's something of an alarm call, mm-hmm. and that strong language, I think, is warranted. But the good news is we're making significant progress in a pretty short time.
Before we talk about that, because your council's only been around a couple of years, you say below the national average. Was there a time when Iowa, in its science education, did better in relation to other parts of the country?
Oh, yeah. The test that everybody kind of considers a hallmark is the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And through the early 90s, Iowa consistently was one of the top states performance-wise on the NAEP, and now our scores are consistently middle of the pack, 24th, 25th, depending on grade level and math or science field.
Mm-hmm. The Governor's STEM Advisory Council has been around for a couple of years. It's a partnership of business, policy, and education leaders from across the state there to bolster STEM education. So when you look at this slip in rankings and overall the increasing need for STEM-educated students, what conclusions do you come to why we are slipping, why we are failing?
Well, I don't think it's so much that Iowa is failing, nor is it so much a matter of slipping as it is a matter of keeping up. Other states of the nation, other nations of the world, have invested much more resources and energy and concentration on STEM pipeline matters than Iowa has. Our kids are holding their own, but there are states such as Tennessee, Texas, California, North Carolina, Ohio that are really making remarkable gains by measures such as the NAEP.
Mm-hmm. So what is actually going on in their schools that you would like to see more of in our schools, since that seems to be effective?
Right. And in some cases, we've replicated some of the promising practices that we've seen in states like Massachusetts and North Carolina. There's obviously a devotion of resources to the professional development of educators in those states. There's public-private partnerships established that we have replicated here in the state to increase the engagement of multiple stakeholders in the STEM education process. And expansion of programs of best practice or of great promise to students across the state so that we don't subject our kids to these pockets of excellence and paucity when it comes to STEM opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Culturally, what's going on here? Because, we want to have kids excited about science. Does our culture necessarily communicate that?
I would argue that our culture doesn't celebrate it as much as we so-called STEMers would like it to be celebrated. There's some wonderful inroads being made in that regard. Some of the programs that we've been able to scale up in the state, First Lego League, for example, or Project Lead the Way, or Hyperstream, and some of these other exemplars that we've had the great opportunity to help grow across the state, really create a celebratory environment that can help participants feel as accomplished as a state qualifying basketball team might feel. So there's a cultural gap. There's a what is celebrated in our state and in our nation does not always align with what powers our economy, but we're starting to make some headway.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Yeah, we have schools, colleges, and when you say, well, what do we celebrate most of all in our colleges, our universities, maybe even our high schools, we point to sports when it's actually the academics that should be the core, right?
Yeah, and it's coming around. You know, there's I don't know too many of the state champions in say, state science and technology fair that were feted with school assemblies, but it's coming. I think there's a lot more attention being given to these intellectual accomplishments than even in the last half a decade to decade.
You, prior to entering academia, you're at the University of Northern Iowa now as an associate professor of biology. You taught high school for 11 years prior to that. When you think about what makes kids interested in STEM classes and activities, what comes to mind? How do you spur that interest, awaken something, spark an interest for perhaps a lifelong career?
Right, yeah. There will always be that 5 or 10% of kids in any classroom, the 2 or 3 or 5 out of 25, who, for whatever genetic quirk, are inherently interested in genetics and balancing chemical equations. But for the vast majority—
Say it. They're nerds.
They're my favorite people. But aside from them, we've really got to reach the masses, and we can't sustain the STEM pipeline on that proportion of, you know, quote, nerds. So we've got to broaden the process. And I think most kids make it quite clear to their teachers what they would like that they may not always get. And that comes in the form of a question, when am I ever going to need this? So it's obvious. It's often screamed in the faces of our teachers. Kids are craving relevancy and application and meaning behind what it is they're being asked to learn and memorize and process. So this is not rocket science. It's not even a well-kept secret that the more we can build in applications and problem-solving and authentic experiences and group work and to help the classroom seem more like an authentic real-world experience, the more likely we are to draw the masses into STEM post-secondary and ultimately to STEM careers.
Your thoughts on STEM education? If you'd like to join our conversation with Jeffrey Weld, Executive Director of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council, 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Also joining us now, Gina Schottemann, Emeritus Associate Professor of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa and director of a festival series called I Explore STEM, joining us by phone. Hi, Gina.
Hi.
This is a festival series taking place in Iowa that aims to change the culture of STEM learning through festivals. Why did you pick festivals?
When I first came to doing this, I thought festivals were the dumbest idea on the planet.
Okay.
And then I changed my thinking because what I realized as I actually went and attended some of these festivals was that a lot of people just don't have any exposure to STEM. They don't really understand what STEM is. And it goes back to what Jeff said a few minutes ago, is they need to see the relevance of STEM in their life. And they're never going to get interested in doing STEM if they don't see the relevance. And in these festivals, the public, kids and adults alike, have a chance to meet people who do science for a living, who do STEM for a living, and they get to see how that relates to jobs and how it relates to what they do in their everyday life. And so I thought it was a really important way to connect kids and STEM and you know, make that connection between what goes on in your real life and then what goes on in school.
Ooh, what a neat idea. So it's the equivalent of meeting that big linebacker at ISU or
exactly.
Iowa State, and you get to tell your kid who you see has an interest in science, we're going to meet someone who actually, you know, deals with, I don't know, nanotechnology. I don't know, right?
Correct, yeah. And you see them, that science isn't these people with white hair and glasses in a white lab coat, that, you know, the person who works at the Department of Natural Resources, the fireman who's doing hazmat, that these people are all STEM people. They're people doing STEM. That STEM is part of everybody's career.
Mm-hmm. So you see, where are these festivals taking place? How can people find out about them, and where are they taking place?
So they've been all over the state. This year, I think the number was 11 of them occurred around the state, and they were all over. We had them in Des Moines. We had them in Spencer, Iowa, Tama County, Dubuque, Des Moines, Davenport, Muscatine. So in many places. And then we do not host all of those. iExplore STEM does not host all of those festivals, but what we do is support the different communities in their hosting the festivals. We have a manual that helps them to put together a festival, and then we ask to help them promote it, that they send their festival information to us, and then we promote it through our website at iExploreSTEM.org.
Okay, let's go to our callers. So you have questions about STEM education, science education in Iowa, 1-866-780-9100. Gina Schottemann with us, director of the festival series iExplore STEM, along with Jeffrey Weld, executive director of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council. Paul is joining us by phone from Mason City. Hi, Paul. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm trying to be a good listener to your show, and I noticed on the last segment that one of your guests said 14% of people with PhDs in science get work in their field. And I don't want to say anything against science education. I think it's wonderful. I think it's great and everything. But I find that if I were going to suggest to my child, hey, be sure and go into STEM because you have a 14% chance of getting work in your field.
Okay, good question, Paul. Let's put it to Jeffrey Weld.
Great question, Paul. Although I'm not familiar with the statistic, I can imagine that there's a lot of nuances to its citation. It could be a regional glut in terms of talent in metro regions of the U.S. It could be that particular fields of STEM have a glut of talent. The life sciences are kind of legendary in that regard. It could be that it's a positive sign that PhDs in the sciences are so highly sought after in management positions that they skip the STEM-related bench science for management, which I hear of more and more, in particular with engineers.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about STEM and motivating people to go in this direction with their education, and parents are certainly a part of any child's from teenage years on up on to finding a good career path, it has to be part of the equation, right? How likely am I to find a job in my desired field of science? How do you address that in your council?
Well, it's a well-cited, often-cited statistic that within this decade we can expect the STEM career opportunities to grow at about four times the rate of career opportunities in other fields. So we're trying to convey that message to parents and children. Interestingly, an evaluative report that was just released last week for the first year of the council's activities included a random survey of parents across Iowa, 59% of whom said that it's highly likely their child will enter a STEM profession eventually. And what wonderful news for us when you consider that it's between 12 and 14% currently. So if this survey bears true, we'll enjoy a four times greater pipeline infusion in the coming decade or so.
Gina Schottemann, do you have anything to say as far as careers in science go?
Yeah, I think that statistic is a little misleading, too, because, for example, I got my PhD in theoretical chemistry, but I have been teaching and been working in the area of health and human physiology for many years now. So by that statistic, I did not get a job in my field.
Mm.
But I'm still a scientist, and I'm still doing science, and I love it. Also, many people, as you suggested, you may get a PhD, but you go to work in government, okay? So, you know, the EPA, or as we saw, the Department of Natural Resources, those kinds of things. And often those aren't counted as in their field because they're administrative, but they're certainly using their science every day of their life.
Okay, Paul in Mason City, great question. I see nuances are your answer, I guess, huh?
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. But I'm also, it brings to mind, you know, about call the constant call for, we don't have enough scientists. And then I hear of folks in their 50s who say, you know, I had a great job in science, but they were able to hire three people from, you know.
Yeah. So it's hard to talk about the field. You know, science is huge. So I guess we have to be more specific. But a great query there, Paul, in Mason City.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. Let's go to Corey in Dubuque before the hour ends. So we talk about science education, literacy in Iowa. Corey, what's on your mind?
I've got a four-year-old daughter, and I agree that science and technology is very important. I'm just looking for any thoughts or suggestions any of the panel members would have as to activities or to do with her to kind of spark her interest in science and technology.
Okay, I'm sure both Gina and Jeffrey have something to say on this. Gina, would you go first, please?
Sure. I mean, there are actually so many opportunities. It's hard to say where to start with that. If assuming you have access to the World Wide Web, there are a number of different resources on the web, even for children at that age. For example, First Lego League, some of the that will start with children at very early ages. But, you know, truthfully, the simplest thing that you can do is go to the library, get a book of science experiments, and just do some science at home with your child and just have fun doing science. And you can find out, maybe she likes building towers, so she want, you know, focus on engineering. Maybe she likes solving math problems. Do that. Just do whatever spark you see in her. Follow up on that. But you don't need to do anything fancy. You know, build a volcano in your house with a baking soda. Just something simple. Just play with her, but use science in your play.
Oh, that sounds great. How many baking soda vinegar experiments did I do in my childhood? A great number. Corey, have you been doing that with your four-year-old? Things like that?
We're always doing some sort of little project with her, playing with her, doing something different. But
okay.
I like the idea of going to the library and then just building some sort of project from there. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Corey, calling from Dubuque. Jeffrey, did you have anything to add to Corey's question?
Sure. I'm going to make it even easier. At the Parents tab at iowastem.gov, there's an A through Z list of parent-child activities that are readily available, kitchen-ready, and I would direct Corey and any parent who'd like to engage their child in STEM to visit the list at iowastem.gov under parents.
iowastem.gov and go to parents. There's some practical information for a way forward for your youngster who may be interested in science and may become one of our lovable nerds, well-employed lovable nerds. Let's talk about this email from Charlie. How do we get universities to increase their interest in doing STEM outreach, asks Charlie, as a vital part of their mission? Jeffrey, you want to tackle that one?
Oh, Charlie, it's a great question. It's right in our wheelhouse. You know, we follow the lead of a couple of states that we think are defining the curve in STEM, one of which is Massachusetts. And one of the enviable aspects of the Massachusetts STEM Initiative is how they have corralled the services of faculty from 130 institutions of higher education. Here in Iowa, we have 30 or 32, depending on how you define them. And we're actually in active engagement now with faculty across our universities to build outreach and engagement. Now, that said, I need to point out that there's some wonderful STEM outreach taking place across our university, private college, community college system, but we want to get from under 50% engagement to up in the 80, 90% engagement. So that's our goal over the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. You've been in place there. The council has been in place. You are the executive director of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council for 2 years. What are the number one successes you can point to that the council has been in charge of?
Well, the top a couple of accomplishments, we've built out of thin air a statewide STEM network of six regional hubs and six managers overseen by six advisory boards that are connecting the public sector and the private sector. We just had the release of our first year monitoring report, which indicates that interest is increased on the part of the kids who participated in our programming last year. Achievement is increased on the part of those same kids. We still have some nagging, vexing challenges, the gender gap in interest and achievement, the ethnic, racial, minority participation interest gap, the geographic disparity in terms of opportunities. But ultimately, that report, which is readily available again at our website, indicates there's strong awareness and support on the part of the public, and the programming that rolled out last year impacting about 38,000 Iowa kids is translating into real and rapid payoff in terms of interest and achievement.
Jeffrey Weld, thank you very much. Executive Director of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council, Gina Schottemann, Emeritus Associate Professor of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa, Director of the Festival Series I Explore STEM. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese, and help from Jason Burns and Tony Daner. Charity Nebbe stepped into the studio. What do you got for us tomorrow on Talk of Iowa at 10 o'clock, Charity?
It's a horticulture day tomorrow,
oh, yeah,
of course.
It's Friday.
And we have a special treat. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here, and we are going to talk about insect song.
A buggy show. Charity, thanks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.